accession number 2317. Sorry, accession number 23192, real 1.
Roy Griffiths, Reel 3. We were talking about your experiences when the tank was held up in Belgium.
Oh, yes. Yes, well, we were there about 8 weeks before finally a unit, a third line base workshops passed through the village and discovered us. They repaired us and took us some time to make our way up to the regiment, who was by that time was in Holland. Holland.
So while you were in Belgium, how did you get on with the local population?
Very well indeed. Very well. They were very good to us. I suppose relieved to see us. Yes, they were very good indeed.
Had they been badly treated by the occupying German forces?
I didn't see much evidence of it, to be honest. And if they had, they didn't say anything. Whether perhaps that part of Belgium wasn't occupied very heavily, I don't know.
Just to take you back a little, you mentioned that you were in the Conne area. Mm. Where exactly, which beach did you land at when you came in just after D-Day?
I'm not terribly sure, to be honest. I think it was Gold. What was termed Gold Beach. It's rather touching because we came up the beach and just sort of camped, and I took a wander around just to see, and there was a house and an elderly Frenchman came out with his daughter, and I just said, you know, bonjour, and in passing, and he came over to me with a rose and handed me this rose. So I just thanked him and went on, and actually I stuck it behind the cap badge in my berry. And on the way back I passed them and they ho 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 and they saw the rose in my berry. I removed it very quickly before the sergeant major noticed, but otherwise.
Did you see much action after leaving the beaches?
Well, as I think I said, we were constantly on the move. There was action, and there was action. There was a lot of sitting in position. Hold down. Waiting, watching for Tiger tanks or something of that nature. Because in positions like that, invariably one of the crew, not me, because I was on the wireless all the time, but would nip out and perhaps get behind the tank and light a fire and brew up. so we'd have a mug of tea.
What food rations did you have?
Well, they were, of course, the compo rations. But invariably, you know, you see, the only time you could eat really was during the day, because at night the regiment would pull back out of whatever positions they were in and go into leaguer, which meant they'd find a large field somewhere and you'd drive in squadron by squadron with the tanks all in line, one after another, row upon row. And while you're in that position, the trucks with the petrol, cans of petrol, would come up and go up the line of tanks, and you'd refuel your tank. So while all that was going on, you couldn't light a fire, because by that time nightfall was coming on, you didn't show a light. So whatever eating had to be in daylight, or what seemed to me usually inside the tank. At the back of the tank, virtually where at the back of where the wireless set was a large metal box, and invariably we keep the rations in there. So it was a case of sort of lifting yourself out of the turret, lifting the lid of this thing and getting out tins of whatever there was. My favourite was the bacon. It was bacon rolled with greased paper, and you undid the tin and out would come this bacon. You'd unroll it, long white sheet, all greasy, and you'd break off bits of bacon, eat it and eat it raw. Oh, it was smashing, tastes like ham. I've never tasted bacon like it in all my life, certainly not since the war. Oh, and there'd be tins of fruit and things like that, and we'd just sort of pass it around among the crew and down to the driver down below.
How many are there in the Sherman crew?
Well, in a 70, I'm beating the guy up, I hadn't yet graduated to 17 pounder, but a 75 millimetre, there were five. The tank commander, the gunner, the wireless operator were up in the turret with the driver and the lap gunner down below. The job, of course, of each, the wireless operator, for instance, the bottom part of the tank turret was cut away, and the shells, armour piercing, smoke, and high explosive shells, were all packed in head downwards. So in action, the gunner would be given a target, and the tank commander would yell HE action. So the wireless operator would stoop down and grasp the end. There was a clip on the end of the shell, and he'd grasp this clip, pull it up onto his knee, turn to his right and push it into the breech of the gun and shout loaded. And the gunner would then get onto his target, and on the given order of the tank commander, he'd fire. The wireless operator also had a machine gun in front of him, which he was responsible for keeping clear. Again, it was an American 300 machine gun, which was apt at times to jam, and the job of the wireless operator was simply to clear the jam so they could carry on firing. But the firing mechanism was worked by the gunner.
How many rounds would you hold of shells and machine gun ammunition?
To be quite honest, I have forgotten. Perhaps 30 of the heavy stuff, and the machine gun bullets, of course, were on belts, which were in green boxes, which clipped onto the side of the machine gun. We'd have about six boxes of those, I suppose. Perhaps up to 1,000 rounds in each.
How much fuel could you take on board, and what range would it give you?
So long ago, I've forgotten my statistics. It would... Let me remember back. I seem to remember on each vehicle there was something about like six jerry cans thrown up. Now a jerry can...
5 gallons, isn't it?
Something like that, yeah. So it'd be about 30 gallons, you know, at a time. It just depended on the terrain you had to go over, how far you went. I seldom remember any tank running out of fuel before nightfall. So the distances varied, you know. Certainly it was important at that time, going up through France, up into Belgium, into Holland. It was a chase. We were chasing them. So you had to keep going.
Where did you sleep at night?
Well, when the regiment went into Liga, where the tanks all lined up, you'd then get out and dig a trench about 6 foot by 8 foot. And about 3 to 4 feet deep, enough to allow you to lie down and sleep. That when Jerry, as he often did, put down a stonk, and it came all over the place, you know. Because, of course, the rumour was that there were people up church towers watching us and radioing back to the Germans where tanks were leaguered. And they'd get onto it, because it was funny. Nearly always seemed to happen. Seldom would you get a a Liga where they didn't send down something, or an aeroplane.
Were you aware at that time which German regiments you were faced against?
No, not really. No, all that was handled presumably by military police and that. I can only remember engaging the enemy from some distance, to be quite honest. And I can remember seeing running figures and moving vehicles and things, you know, we stirred up a hornet nest. But I never really saw them close up, not until the end of the war.
Can you remember any funny incidents at the time?
Well, invariably, when we go into a position, usually our position, we'd move into a position that had been vacated by the Germans, who had, of course, obligingly built slit trenches all over the place. And each squadron, they would appoint one slit trench to be the latrine. And they carried a sort of Hessian screen, which was hurriedly placed around this slit trench. And so you answer the call to nature by going in and trying to disrobe. I say disrobe because tank crews at that time not only wore battle dress, but overalls over the top. We were not allowed, I mean, where the infantry were able to go in shirt sleeve order, we had to wear all this gear with a waist belt from which was suspended a revolver. This was because if the tank was hit, it would brew up, as we called it. If it was anywhere near the petrol tank, the whole thing would go up in flames. Well, so many more men were lost in the early part of the war through being just in shirt and shorts. They were burnt so badly that the orders were that we had to wear our full gear. It was even worse in winter, because in winter they issued us with a waterproof suit which zipped all the way up from your each ankle right the way up the front of your body. And it had a hood. It was supposed to keep out the wet and that. Wasn't much good. Because, to be honest, Sherman tanks were devised in America, I think in the Arizona desert. And when a tank started up, you got a rush of cold air, came right up through the turret. And it was, in winter, it was freezing. You could never get warm at all, no matter what you wore. Anyway, with all this clothing on, if you went to the latrine, you had to somehow get it all off so you could operate. Well, I mean, it took you ages getting it all down and making sure you didn't do anything on it, on the inside, And one poor chap, in the course of his squirming about, his revolver and belt fell down into the pit. So after he'd finished, he went back to the Sergeant Major and reported that he'd lost his pistol in the latrine. Whereupon Sergeant Major told him, go back and get it. So the poor chap had to go back and move the clothes up his arm and grope around in all the mess in the pit until he found his belt. Well, he stank to high heaven and nobody would go near him for days afterwards. But that was, you know, the disadvantages of the clothing that we had to wear.
Were you in the relief of Caen?
Yes, we were in that action. It was a bit, I don't remember a great deal, I mean, much of the time. You know, you close down, you have only the periscope to look through. You can follow, as a wireless operator, I could follow much of what was going on because you were on one wireless net for the whole regiment. You could hear the commanding officer telling the various squadrons and tank commanders where to go and what to do. And you could hear them replying and reporting back. So one had a fair idea of what was going on, but the overall picture, I'm afraid, you know. All I remember of Cole is afterwards we drove through when it was where it was just the smoking ruins that I could see, but all was left, what was left standing, was the statue to William the Conqueror. And that seemed to be intact.
Were you involved with the tank battle at Tilly?
No, I don't really remember that one. I may have been, but, you know, there were just little bits and pieces that comes back to mind. Half the time I wasn't very sure where we were.
Did you have much contact with the local population?
Sometimes we'd drive through towns and villages. Sometimes it wasn't very happy. I mean, wasn't their fault, poor devils. We had extra large tins which were welded on the back of the tank, right at the back by the exhaust above the tracks. We often kept bits of rations in there. Half the time you drive through and a crowd would collect and they'd be opening these tins and grabbing what they could out of it. Poor devils, I suppose they were hungry. Other odd times, you know, one spoke to the odd person and the odd policeman, you know. But they're not a great deal of contact at all, no. Until Belgium.
So having had your vehicle repaired in Belgium, what happened next?
Well, I arrived back at the squadron.
How many tanks are there in a squadron?
One, two, three. There's usually four troops and four tanks, or there were, you know, it's different now, obviously. Four troops. and each troop had four tanks. That was the troop leader. For instance, over the wireless, he would get it, they'd give the code name, Charlie Four was the troop leader, Four troop. Four Able was the troop sergeant. Four Baker would be a corporal. Four Charlie, again, would be a corporal. Tank commanders.
Were you a trooper during this time?
All the way through, yes, trooper. Until the end.
And you left Belgium where you'd been?
Yes, Belgium.
Did you have to catch up with your unit? Or?
Yes, well, we did. As I say, they were in Holland. And they had received notification of our arrival. I always remember trundling along this road to the headquarters of C Squadron, and the squadron sergeant major stood looking, slowly nodding his head as we arrived. Of course, we had to, I don't know what, the tank commander, who was a corporal, had to give an account of what had happened. How well he embellished it, I don't know, I think he did a little bit. Because the same sergeant major, you know, years later used to say to me, you know, what was the true story about you lot in Belgium? Never gave the show away. Well, no show to give away, really. It wasn't our fault. We were lost.
How did you pass those 8 weeks?
In the cafe, really, most of the time.
And you met some local girls?
Yes. Yes. It was a pleasant little interlude, you know. Another step in my education. Oh, dear.
So, you got back to your RSM?
Yep. And, well, by that time it was getting winter of 44.